I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Letty Naranjo. She's executive director of Literacy Volunteers of Santa Fe. And we are also joined by Kevin Morshed, who is the basic literacy coordinator for that organization. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you've got some tutor trainings coming up for literacy volunteers, which we're going to talk about in a little while. But you've got all kinds of programs going on in literacy volunteers, including adult literacy, which I guess is that the main thing that you focus on, is adults whose basic reading skills are not up to par?
Yeah, we help adults for the most part who are reading at a sixth grade level or below. We are pretty much an adult literacy program, so that means all of our students are, you know, pretty much above the age of 18, and it's really focused on, you know, helping them become better parents, helping them obtain their goals, whether it be get the GED, and some of our English as a second language students want to become citizens, want to be able to communicate with teachers, participate more in the community. So we are helping their parents.
We hear so much about third graders who can't read. Those are the people who later become the adults who can't read? I mean, is this a kind of long-term systemic problem that we're talking about?
Yeah, I believe so, because, you know, we talk about, you know, generational problems with literacy, so it does kind of pass through from a father, a mother, to their children, because obviously they aren't getting the help that they need at home. So our focus is more on the parents, which I think in mainstream media and whatnot, you do get the story of the kids who are illiterate, but by far and large, the argument is made by their teachers that it really depends on what they're doing at home. So that's where Literacy Volunteers of Santa Fe comes in. We really want to serve the children's parents so they in turn can be helped at home. So
what kind of programs do you have, and what really works for adults? They don't have that kind of incredibly open capacity for language acquisition, of course, that children have.
Well, our programs are designed to help the student where the student is at the student's level. And so they come to us as adults. They've already kind of failed in an educational system, especially the ones that are coming to us to learn how to read. And so we provide one-to-one tutoring, and we also provide small group tutoring. So it really depends on the student, the student's levels, what they're coming to us for, if it's for basic reading or writing, or if it's English as a second language. Our English as a second language programs are pretty much all small group instruction. And so that really works because they get to practice their English skills with the other students in the group.
Now, your English as a second language students, do they tend to be literate in their native languages?
No, not all the time. A lot of times they come to us with only a second or third grade level, education level in their own language.
Which is usually Spanish?
Usually Spanish, but we do have students from all over the world. We have students from Russia, we have Tibetan students, Asian students.
And so you work with all of these folks, and I imagine that if they've gotten to a place where they're adults and they've had academic failures, that there's all kinds of other failures that they've had with workplace things and so on. And so you're really, in a way, I would think, kind of dealing with the whole person and with the kind of social system that has created this whole world of people who are illiterate.
Yes, a lot of times our students walk in on their own, and many times an employer will refer them or come in with them, or their spouses or family members will come in with them. And so we try to help them with their basic communication skills, in their work skills, you know, whatever it is that they need.
Yeah, and if you think about the social services that are offered for anybody in general, there are always gaps. So there are reasons why we still see homeless people. There are reasons why we see all these other domestic abuse, you know, illiteracy. We can talk about all these issues. There's huge gaps in our kind of social structure. So it is true, when I go to work every day, it's something new comes up, and that's kind of, you know, in one way, I really, you know, it keeps me going for sure. But another way, it kind of makes me realize there are all these gaps. So, you know, I could have a student that, you know, just has some learning issues, might be a learning difference, you know, there might be a gap in the public educational system where he or she's not, gotten the help that they needed. Especially
because
if
they were dyslexic, let's say.
Mm-hmm, dyslexic, or, you know, what we call, or mainstream perhaps calls slow, or, you know, takes a longer time to learn, doesn't learn so well in a classroom environment. Might be ADHD, which is kind of a new phenomena, I think, amongst, you know, children as well as, you know, their parents. All these things are relatively new in terms of the diagnoses. So, you know, these students do have these issues come up, and they're not able to get help, even beyond their educational issues that do come up. So when they come to the Literacy Volunteers of Santa Fe, we get their whole story of their experience in education. And because it is one-to-one tutoring for the most part, it really kind of, we have to match them up appropriately, meaning that we find a tutor that is going to be well-suited for them, whether it's they have the same interest, you know, the same kind of, you know, outlook, personality. It's almost like it's
your matchmaking
literacy program with a mentor element to it, for sure. And we do refer them constantly to different agencies. We work with an advisor because we are housed at the Santa Fe Community College. We do have a lot of other resources, thankfully, because they do house us, and we're able to make those connections sometimes even better than agencies that are really primed to do these specific things.
Well, Santa Fe Community College is amazing. Mm-hmm. They've got so many resources, and they have so much experience with dealing with people who are struggling.
Yes.
Do you find that some people have shame about coming in and saying that they need help with reading?
Yeah, you know, we like to think when they come to see us that they've kind of at least made the first step. It's almost as if, you know, somebody comes into a meeting and says, you know, I have a problem with, you know, drinking. So they've kind of just let that huge bag of kind of negative energy fall away. But there are many cases where I take phone calls from adult students who are crying, who really can't even speak because they're so afraid of perhaps somebody finding out. Or, you know, a lot of times it's just a matter of having a conversation and them feeling like there's somebody actually there to listen, finally, that there's an actual program out there for them that can help them.
Yeah. There's so much. I remember I used to tutor when I first moved to Santa Fe and worked at Santa Fe Community College. And there were so many, I noticed emotional barriers that were in the way of learning even simple math. It wasn't that they couldn't learn it. They were perfectly smart, but they just didn't think that they could do it, and therefore they got really blocked up emotionally.
I see that too. I mean, that's a real strength, and that's kind of one of those gap things. You're thinking, well, there's kind of different perceptions going on because of the way society is set up.
Yeah.
So if they got beat up at school, more or less, because they were a little slow, because they were a little different, and definitely if they're an older student, which we tend to serve, you know, these diagnoses of dyslexia or ADHD weren't around. So they definitely were doubled, kind of stigmatized in a lot of ways. Mm. And sometimes, yeah, they are fluent readers, but because they were told over and over, even from a parent, that they were pretty much stupid and good for nothing, there are those kind of emotional blocking points.
We're talking to Literacy Volunteers of Santa Fe. Now, Letty, you've been doing this for so long. What are some of the success stories that you've seen? Because you must have followed people's stories over years and decades.
Yes, we've had many, many success stories. I started with the program about 18 years ago, and we actually have a couple of students that are still with us that started 18 years ago, but they've made great progress. One in particular came and started at a second grade reading level, and he now is works at a radio station.
Oh, my goodness.
And when he came to us, his goal was to become a DJ. And, you know, everybody kept telling him, you can't read, you'll never do that, you won't be able to read announcements. And by golly, that made him even more determined.
Amazing.
And it's amazing.
And he's a DJ.
And he's a DJ. Yes, at a local radio station here in Santa Fe.
Extraordinary. That's so amazing. But I imagine most people don't stay for that long.
No, most people don't stay that long. Our ESL students pretty much come and are with us for a year or two. And, you know, they learn English and they're very successful in the community. They're working. They get promoted in their jobs. And we have so many stories. This last fiscal year, we had 12 students that became citizens.
Yeah, you have these citizenship groups.
Yes.
What are they?
And, well, we have tutors that are working with students specifically to study to become citizens. And so that's really exciting. We got a small grant from the New Mexico Community Foundation. And it was through one of their funders, it was specifically targeting women. And so we're helping women, more women become citizens.
Now, you also have Spanish basic literacy.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Okay. Years ago, we found that a lot of our students weren't educated in their first language. And so it was really difficult for them to learn English as a second language because they had no literacy in their first language. So our national office, ProLiteracy, actually did this pilot study and began Spanish literacy. And so we were one of the programs in New Mexico that piloted that. And I think now, how many tutors do we have, Kevin?
Well, I think currently we have about 5. Tutors working about, 7 to 10 students. And that's, I think, one of the coolest programs. And it is, Letty was saying, it's a pilot program. It's one of very few programs in the whole United States doing this kind of work. And if you can imagine somebody that wasn't literate in their native language from a country that, might have been in political turmoil or, they weren't very, didn't have the economic resources, etc. There's a lot of other issues to see them kind of overcome not only that, but become literate in their native language and also work to become literate in English.
So the two things go together.
They do, yeah. So it's kind of a pathway. So they start with Spanish, and depending on their, the reasons why they need the literacy in their native language might determine how long that they need in that instruction. And once they get a good foundation in their native language, currently is the only one we're teaching is in Spanish, they can move on to an ESL and English as a second language class and really meet the goals that they have, in everyday life here in the U.S.
Now, some of the groups you have meet not at the Santa Fe Community College, but at other places as well. Where else can people join groups?
We have many community groups, and they're, for example, at the public libraries. We have some that meet at some of the public schools. We're at a lot of churches in town, a couple of public health clinics. We also have workplace sites where the volunteer tutor goes into the workplace to teach English as a second language. And I think this past year we might have had about 8 work sites. Some are the hotels or the restaurants.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, it's very directly related to economic development, even in our own state of New Mexico and in Santa Fe. We do go out in the community centers. We do a lot of outreach because these individuals, obviously English as a second language is very apparent to an employer when a customer or a client asks him or her a question in English.
Right.
It's evident that they're not able to respond. So a lot of employers are catching on to that and really giving their employees time and compensation for their time and with one of our volunteer tutors in English second language class. And then we do a lot of outreach as well to find the individuals that are obviously out there because New Mexico does have a 46% functionally illiterate population.
46%?
Functionally illiterate. And these are old numbers, to be honest. So it's probably even worse today than it was about 10 years ago when the data was collected. And that's not even including the ESL population. So we're talking about pretty much native English-speaking adults in New Mexico.
So that's not including, for example, Spanish-speaking immigrants.
Right. Right.
Something is deeply wrong, ladies and gentlemen, with our schools and with the whole system.
Right, and I just don't know why it's not a bigger mainstream issue in our, you know, in our everyday lives. It does become apparent when we do talk to our community members, including our volunteer tutors, when that figure is astonishing. But when we talk to people, they take a few seconds and then they think about who they know that have these issues. And by far and large, somebody knows somebody with these issues. So,
or they know somebody with those issues but don't realize that they know that person is functionally illiterate.
Right, right. And functional literacy has, you know, kind of a broad definition. But it's pretty much what we take for granted every day by reading a newspaper, by filling out a form, job application, resume, that kind of thing.
Right. Now, you are always looking for volunteers. It's Literacy Volunteers of Santa Fe. So what is the commitment that volunteers make once they sign up to do this work? And what do they have to be able to do? I mean, they have to be able to read, but what skills do they need?
One of the biggest thing I think that comes up in the training is patience. So one of those things is all the issues that we've been talking about, being open to an individual that perhaps has this, you know, long history of being defeated in school and not being able to keep a job and kind of having these issues at home and whatnot. So it takes a great deal of patience. And I think for the basic literacy students, half the battle is just really meeting with someone like this one-to-one and giving them an opening to be able to discuss what they haven't been able to discuss for years, sometimes 30, 40 years. We see individuals sometimes even 70 years old come to us, you know, and sometimes they have tears in their eyes still because it's such a huge issue. And so we're trying to do a better job of reaching out. And the more volunteers we have to communicate what we're doing out in the community, the better that we can serve the community. So volunteer tutors, you know, and we take them through a kind of an extensive training, 20-hour training. Our next one's coming up at the end of September. And we get them trained, and then we get them paired up with an individual. And we do all the intake procedures. We get kind of what they're interested in, when they're available, you know, and we're pretty flexible because we are all over Santa Fe and we can meet any time of the day because we are one-to-one.
Right, so you, if somebody works the night shift, then they meet with the tutor when they go off of work, whatever time of day that is, or if they work the day shift, the tutor finds whatever their free time is to match up with it.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of our volunteers are retired individuals, former teachers, but then a lot of them are working individuals. And to be honest, you can't really tell the difference between a former teacher and somebody that's coming from the workforce, or somebody that's 20 years old versus somebody that's 60 years old. We love all of our volunteer tutors. They're just as different as our students. And so we can't really label our volunteer tutors in any one way. It really just takes patience and a kind of an openness.
How much do they usually work with students per week? In other words, do you require a couple of hours or?
It's about approximately 4 to 6 hours per week commitment.
And so you have the 20-hour training and then 4 to 6 hours per week. So it's a real commitment. What do your volunteers say? Do they find it fulfilling work?
Oh, they do. We have so many stories. We have, we're having our recognition event coming up at the end of the month at Frenchie's Field Park. And so we give out awards to our volunteer tutors and our students. And we started giving out service awards, oh, I would say probably maybe 10 years ago. But we have volunteer tutors that have been with us over 20 years, over 15 years,
oh my
and
goodness.
Over 10 years. So they really, really stick with us, and, you know, they form a really tight relationship with their students. Some of our students call their kids, our students' kids call the tutor grandma.
Yeah.
And so it's just, you know, they build these special relationships with the students, and it's really fulfilling for them.
And then the 4 to 6 hours is including kind of transportation, prep time, and any other kind of workshops that we offer as well. But tutoring time itself is usually 2 to 3 hours per week. And then, of course, you have prep, and then you do have, you know, transportation if it is somewhere in Santa Fe.
And in those 2 to 3 hours, do you usually work with one person that whole time or a couple of different people?
Right. It really depends on the program and the need. So basic literacy, which is for individuals that are native English speakers who can't read past the 6th grade reading level, we always pair them up 1-to-1 because there's all these different issues that will come up during a tutoring session. So it's very vital that 1-to-1 tutoring is going on. But our ESL is obviously, you know, it's conversation-based, so it can be smaller groups. And sometimes, you know, there might be a few cases, depending on the schedules and stuff, where we could match a few students to a tutor, for sure. So we do that all through the intake process and see what a volunteer is comfortable with, what they're interested in, all that. And we give them kind of an opportunity to kind of tell us what they're interested in by giving them a needs list and describing the student or describing the, you know, the workplace or the classroom where they'll be helping with.
Now, you have an upcoming tutor training. Basic literacy tutor training is September 27th to 29th, and then English as a second language training is October 11th and 13th. So those are coming up fairly soon. If people want to sign up for them, what should they do?
I think the easiest thing is to call 428-1353. That's our main literacy line. And then, of course, they can look on our website and get our contact that way. It's LVSF, that's LVSF.org.
LVSF.org.
Yeah, LVSF.org. So the best way is to call us or email us, and that way we can get them started. And it's pretty much a short application as well as an interview. So we can meet them and kind of describe a little bit better our program and get them signed up for the training because it does fill up.
Does it?
Yeah.
So you've
thankfully, we're in a good place in Santa Fe.
Great.
So it is. It
so
is
you
good.
Don't have a shortage of volunteers.
No, we can. 25 is a class, and the last year we filled the class with 30, and so yeah, they fill up.
That is amazing and wonderful.
Yeah, we're doing a little bit better job of outreaching. Like obviously on today's show here, we're really, you know, we're short staff. We're only 3.25. Staff, so there's pretty much 3 full-time staff members for over 400 students and about 150 volunteer tutors on in a given year.
Yeah.
So we got a lot going on, but we are getting a little smarter in terms of, you know, how we are outreaching to our community. And, you know, Santa Fe is such a great and giving community that we are lucky to have so many volunteer tutors.
Well, once again, the telephone number is 505-428-1353.
Yes.
And the website is LVSF.org, which stands for Literacy Volunteers of Santa Fe, of which Leti Naranjo is the executive director and Kevin Morshed is basic literacy coordinator. Did I get that right? And I want to thank you both so much for being on the air with us today. Anything you want to add before we go?
No, I just say thanks to Santa Fe and thanks for making our program really fill the needs of our community because a lot of literacy programs are dealing with a lot of financial issues currently in the state of New Mexico. So this program is very vital, not only for Santa Fe, but much of the northern region even. So thank you all to the volunteers, the people that donate their time and money to our program to make it happen for all of us.
Yeah, and I want to ditto that. The volunteers are the heart of our program. And if anyone out there would like to become part of our program, we'd love to have you. Yeah, just give us a call.
Well, thank you both so much for being on the Radio Cafe with us.
Thank you.
And today, Labor Day, I'm delighted to welcome to the program Hal Bolton. He is the author of the book War Myths in the Workplace, Ride the Edge of Chaos to a Peaceful Revolution. He has an extensive career in both labor and management, has worked in many positions and consulted for years with the Kaizen Institute of America and many schools and nonprofits as well. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, war myths in the workplace. What is an example of a war myth?
War myths are built around the anybody is the enemy except myself or my corporation, depending upon where you're working. It's competitive. corporations use war myths to define their competition as the enemy. They will use subterfuge, intelligence to get the best of the other corporation. And it's all around, how do we win?
It's interesting that when Japan became a rising economic power, as you write about in your book, some of the Japanese war texts were actually introduced and became real texts for American capitalists.
Absolutely.
What are some examples of that, and what kind of lessons did they take from them?
Well, they were about how to fool your enemy, how to use subterfuge, how to cheat. They were based on the old samurai system of winning wars. What they didn't realize is the Japanese don't use those anymore.
Right.
They use a totally different method of working and working with their people.
One of the things that I think is central to the book is you write about different developmental stages and then apply those developmental stages, childhood, adolescence, adulthood, and so on, to the way groups operate. So it's not only a child acting childish, but you have adults within, for example, corporations acting very childish. What does this look like? How do you see that?
Well, I call it levels of awareness. Just because you're an adult does not mean you behave with adult awareness. We begin with childlike myths. We learn our myths. In adolescence, we live those myths. And sometimes we live the rest of our lives living those myths. Very common in the world today, very common in our country today, and very common in corporations, where the myths are about self-interest, myths are about win-lose. The way you solve problems is by conflict, is by violence or war, or dominance or power.
You gave this example about how when you were a child, when you were actually a child, one of your little playmates hit you over the head with a little rake, a little toy rake, and your mother said, you know, you went home crying, and your mother said, well, hit him back. So you take an iron crowbar, and if your mother hadn't intervened, you might have done total brain damage to this little playmate of yours.
That's childlike awareness.
And that's what people do when they go postal.
And I have seen, I've talked to workers, and I talked to one in one particular company, and he said he was not being respected. He said, I feel like going home and getting my Uzi and taking care of people. Well, that in fact has happened.
Taking care of, quote unquote.
Yes. And, you know, an Uzi is a submachine gun.
Right, right.
And he was so mad, he was ready to take that to work.
Now, it's interesting that in that example, it's actually your mom who taught you to do that.
Yes. That's where you learn the myths. Childlike, you learn the myths. Adolescence, you live those myths.
Now, what is the distinction between childlike responses and adolescent responses in the context of this study that you're doing?
Childlike depends on parental authority. So in many corporations, I've seen workers, and in my own corporation, say, just tell me what you want me to do. Now, that's child-parent relationship. Adolescence, you tend to work with a union and you do how the union works, or you join a gang, or you join a fraternity, or you join an organization, and your identity moves from parental family relationship to this group relationship. So you have an adolescent gang, you have an adolescent reactive union, or...
What's wrong with unions?
Nothing is wrong with unions. Unions were designed to be reactive because their members were not being treated with respect. So I respect unions hugely.
So it looks like, when you describe this, that the American corporate system is in many ways based on a combination of childish and adolescent developmental levels of awareness.
Absolutely.
And so,
and the myths that go with it, they're living with, these myths of economic self-interest, the win-lose myths, they are the enemy myths, those are all adolescents personified.
Right. And then there are alternatives to that, which is what we might call growing up.
We might call it growing up. Now, I differentiate physical growing up from awareness growing up. They are two totally different streams. So when a corporation begins to grow up, they begin to look at and communicate with their people, and they understand that what I'll call value added, and I can explain that in a minute, what value added is from the workers, not from the managers. Managers are all waste. They do not add value to the product. They may add direction, they may add other things, but in the true definition of value added, they are waste.
What do you mean? Let's talk about that for a second. What is value added?
Value added is the last turn of a screw to tighten two pieces together, is producing a piece that is ready to be added to another piece. It is changing a part from one state to a more finished state.
It's taking an apple off a tree and making applesauce and putting it in a jar and selling it.
That's value added.
And so managers don't add any value?
In the true definition of value added, they do not. They think they do, but who actually produces the product? The person on the shop floor, the person in the bakery, or the person in the wherever, they are the ones that add value to the product. Now, what we call managers and those people is not value added but necessary. And a well-managed adult corporation minimizes the amount of non-value added but necessary. In Japan, probably the best corporation was Toyota, and they said their value added to non-value added was about 350 to 1. That is, for every value added unit, there were 350 units of not value added. Now, if I would look at an American corporations, what I would find to the value added may be as high as 10,000 to 1. So that's why we became non-competitive in automobiles and in many other areas, because we were working from the top down instead of from the bottom up.
Do you feel that Toyota, for example, or other similar Japanese corporations provide an example of what, quote-unquote, adult awareness level and adult management looks like?
Yes and no. That's a complex situation. The workers are involved in day-to-day operations and decision-making. The direction still comes from the top, and sometimes too much from the top. In American companies that have adopted the Japanese system, the workers have more part in the decision-making and in the process improvement than some of the Japanese companies do, the good American companies. Most American companies, workers are considered, to use a war term, cannon fodder. They can be laid off, they can be fired, they can be coerced, they can be transferred. We can take our work and transfer it overseas. That is not considering workers or the workers' families or the communities.
And we're kind of creating a vicious cycle, because in the United States, in so many places, our educational level is so bad. We just heard an interview about how functional adult illiteracy in New Mexico is around 50%. And so how can you expect to have a workforce of people making good decisions when they're not properly educated?
That's absolutely true. We had a process in Western New York of retraining workers that had been displaced by companies shutting down. And these workers had been in their job as a small steel mill for years and years. When we came out to talk about them retraining, we found that over 35% could not read or write. They had learned how to do their jobs by rote, but they could not read or write. And I have many other stories of similar nature. So education is absolutely the ground upon which you have to build an economy.
So if you have a company that is being run in a way that you think is, well, employing these adult levels of awareness, and basically what you're looking for is not war myths, but different kinds of myths, myths of treating each other in a fair and just manner, doing something productive, looking out for the community, looking out for each other. What does that look like at best?
Well, a company that I spent a lot of time with, who chose to be unnamed for whatever their reasons were, I went back and visited them 15 years after our first intervention with them, and they had progressed so much. I interviewed about 40 people there. They make a very precision product that uses tolerances that are in the microns. Now, a micron is a fraction of the diameter of a human hair. So very, very tight, very precise parts. On a brand new design, they made 3 million parts before they had a customer reject, and that reject was a labeling error. I also talked to the people about their involvement in the community. Every employee I talked to were involved in their schools or their churches or their sports teams or some work in the community. So they had taken the participation and this more adult awareness to the levels outside of their corporation to enhance their whole community.
And of course, for that to happen, you have to pay workers fairly so that they have enough time to actually do things besides find a second job.
And this company had a system where they expected every worker to make 3 suggestions to improve their processes every year. When they did, and they all did that, when they did that, there was an award process, a profit-sharing process that went with that. Yes, you have to share with the employees. They have to get the benefits.
There seem to be so many analogies between evolutionary theory and business theory, mm-hmm. and in both theories and in both realities, you've got competition and you've got cooperation, and you kind of need both of those to some extent to have a really functional system. What is the proper role of competition in business, in your view?
Competition keeps you awake, keeps you from going to sleep, and not understanding you have to be as good as everybody else in the world in this process. This company that I talked about that made the 3 million parts, when I talked to one of their managers, he said, hey, we have to do this to compete with our plants, and they have plants all over the world, our plants in Japan, in China, and Mexico. So we have to be this good in order to be competitive in the world.
Now, is a company that is run with profit sharing, for example, that treats its workers well, that pays them well, that allows them autonomy and decision making, do those plants tend also to be more profitable than the top-down run?
Absolutely.
And why is
that? Absolutely. Top-down run, managers know all the answers, but they know little about what goes on in their factories. This sounds ridiculous, but it's absolutely the way it's run. So when you get workers involved in the process and they know what goes on in the factories, then the process is improved, and then your productivity goes up, then your profitability increases also. So the book that you're talking about that I wrote is really a book about the evolution of a corporation from a top-down to a totally participative corporation. So it's an evolutionary process also.
We're talking to Hal Bolton about his book, War Myths in the Workplace. So do people hire you, for example, or hire other consultants to say, we've got a kind of warlike, top-down company and we want to change it to something that's more fair and that makes more money, and help us do that? Does that actually happen?
What happens normally is that we have a problem, and we call it an illness. There was some discomfort in there. So we would become the doctors to help them with their discomfort. Now, most companies, when we would go in and work with a particular problem, and in a very short time we could clean up that problem, they would say, okay, that's fine. See you later. And we'd come back 6 months later, and they were exactly where they had been before, because they had not changed their eyes, looking at their work with different eyes. They were just going back to what they knew how to do.
And it's hard to change habits.
It is very hard, and it takes years. Corporation that I was talking about had been working at this for 15 years, and they're still working at it. And they're still one of the best in the world. And they will be one of the best in the world because they're still working at it. It is not a quick change. It is not a quick fix. When Most corporations called us in. It was like a doctor saying, okay, take 2 aspirin and go to bed, and you'll feel better in the morning. Instead of saying, what do we really have to change? Because a manager would say, look, I got where I am by doing what I know to do and how to do it. Why should I change?
When you think about what an economy, what a peacetime economy is all about, and what a military apparatus is all about, they're really, really different. One is about making things that you eat and wear and drive and talk to each other with and things like that. And one is about fighting and defending against people who want to attack you. And the idea that we would run both of them in the same way is almost absurd. But if you want to replace the war myths with other myths, what are the other myths? What do you call them?
Well, the myths are just treating people like humans. You're believing that there is a connectedness between all of us, that everybody is important, that you have value and can add value, and we pledge to honor that. It's a totally different myth than saying, just do what I tell you to do.
One of the problems, I think, in the world we're living in now is that we are so much living in a competitive marketplace, and the competition is intense, and we have ever saturated and oversaturated markets, meaning everybody already has a refrigerator. You don't really need to make any new ones. Then you have to try to get people to replace perfectly good working refrigerators or whatever it is. And this is because growth is mandated in a capitalist society. And infinite growth, as we know, is unhealthy in nature, and infinite growth is unhealthy for ecosystems. And so how do you, looking at things from an adult perspective, think about this problem?
Well, I think you have to look at the whole myth of free enterprise and the capitalist system and who gets rewarded for it. There is room for consumer purchases. There are new products. They are more efficient or more effective. There are refrigerators now that take less energy, that don't take gases that invade our atmosphere. So there are always improvements that can be made to products. Cars run now much more efficiently than they did last year or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So there's always room for making products that are more effective, more efficient, and more attractive. And in our current economic situation, there also seems to be plenty of opportunities to make war goods, because we sell more war goods than any other country in the world. Our budget for the military is more than the next 10 countries put together. It's a huge, huge economic dilemma. And that balance has to be rebalanced and changed. And that's why I use the edge of chaos, because we are entering a chaotic situation. And with uncertainty theory, chaos always breeds change. And change always results from chaos. And that is going to have to happen if we're going to get our economy straightened out.
The last level of awareness that you write about in your book, War Myths in the Workplace, is life master, and that's the next level past adult. So you go child, adolescent, adult, and life master. What does that mean, and what is the inspiration for that term and that way of thinking?
Well, I was trying to find a term that wasn't too new agey. And life mastery means that you understand what humankind is all about. You know that other humans are important in the world. You know that whether people are starving in Africa, we should be doing something about that and not just say, well, I make more profits doing this than I would doing that. It's living without mythology. It's living with a sense of total oneness, total connectedness.
So you've transcended your war myths and your peace myths, and you're living without any myths.
That's correct.
And is that from Eastern philosophy or something?
I've studied it all, and it's a combination of many, many philosophies. This is a collection from years and years of having a foot in one in two worlds, the esoteric world and the practical world.
Do you think that nations go through developmental phases that mirror an individual's life cycle? There are childish nations and adult nations and adolescent nations.
Absolutely. I spent some time with a friend in Africa. We talked about doing some business down there. And you thought you were dealing with a bunch of children. And now they were growing towards adolescence because they had to have an airline. Okay, everybody else has an airline, so I have to have an airline. Everybody else has a steel mill, so I have to have a steel mill. Now, we have no raw materials, but I have to build a steel mill for $1 billion. And so that's the growth of an African nation. It's a very large one, not South Africa, but a very large one that was moving into the adolescent stage. Will they get to an adult stage? I asked a question to one of their ministers when we were dealing with their government there. It was about language. I said, Dr. Upubra, you have many, many, many dialects in this country. He said, oh, yes, we have 500 or 1,000. I said, do you think you'll ever get a common language? He said, oh, yes. How long do you think that'll take? Oh, 500 years. So nation development is painstakingly slow. You would hope you could do something faster. Look at what South Africa's gone through. They went to an adult stage. Now they're kind of teetering between adolescent and adult. And you look at Eastern Europe and seeing what happened there, and they now have gone back to a more adolescent, most of them.
What about the United States?
We're totally adolescent. As a government, we are totally adolescent. Now there are one or two statesmen, but they're getting rarer and rarer because of the money issues, frankly, money and power, and that's totally adolescent. And until we break that through and get Citizens United out of the way so we can begin to talk about what real government is like and what government should really be representing, that we're going to remain in the adolescent stage. We may be here for quite a while.
And what economies are for?
Economies are for feeding and supplying humankind.
And not necessarily for 1% of those humankind to get fabulously wealthy at the rest of our expense.
You know, I never figured out, what do you do with a salary of $200 million?
I know, I've thought about that a lot. What do you want to buy?
What more can you buy? And what I found out was that those salaries have nothing to do with their performance. It has to do with what somebody else in a similar position was getting paid. So adolescence again.
Right. The book is called War Myths in the Workplace, Ride the Edge of Chaos to a Peaceful Revolution. Hal Bolton has been speaking with us today, Labor Day. Now, where can people pick up a copy of this book?
They can pick it up from Collected Works. They can pick it up through my website, which is transformingwarmyths.com.
Transformingwarmyths.com.
And I will be at a book show in Los Alamos on September 8th at Fuller Lodge. And they
at what time?
At 9 o'clock to 2.
Excellent. Well, Hal Bolton, we look forward to seeing you there, and thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.